fates, we think this quest of how the fate of Naglimund and all the North may hang on its accomplishing, and of course, that all may be perishing without fame or song in the white northern waste.
He patted Simon's knuckles solemnly, then reached into the pocket of his fur-lined jacket.
Here,
he said, and put something hard and cold into Simon's fingers. Momentarily distracted, he opened his hand to look. It was a ring, a plain, thin circlet of some golden metal. On it was inscribed a simple design, a long oval with a tipped triangle at one end.
The fish sign of the leak of the scroll, Binnebik said. Morgani's tied this thing to the sparrow's leg, along with the note of which I was speaking before. The end of the note told, this was for you.
Simon held it up, trying to catch a gleam of the dull sunlight. I never saw Morgani's wear it, he said, a little surprised that it startled up no memories. Do all the League members have one? Besides, how could I be worthy to wear it? I can hardly read. My spelling isn't very good either. Binnebik smiled.
My master did not have such a ring, or at least I never was seeing it. As for the other, Morgani's was wanting you to have it, and that is permission enough, I have sureness.
Binnebik, Simon said, squinting, it has writing on the inside. He held it up for the troll to inspect. I can't read it. The troll narrowed his eyes.
It is writing in some silly tongue, he said,
turning the ring to peruse its inner rim.
Hard to read for being very small, and in a style I do not know.
He studied it a moment longer.
Dragon, that character means, Binnebik read at last, and this one means, I believe, death. Death and the dragon? Death of the dragon.
He looked up at Simon, grinned, and shrugged.
What it might be meaning, I have no idea. My knowledge is not deep enough. Some conceit of your doctor's is my guessing, or perhaps a family motto. Perhaps Yarnauga could read it with more ease.
It slid easily onto the third finger of Simon's right hand, as though it had been made for him. Morgani's had been so small, how could he have worn this?
Do you think it's a magic ring?
He asked suddenly, narrowing his eyes as though he might detect spells swarming around the golden circle like minuscule bees.
If so, Binnebik said mock-somberly, Morgani's included no grammary for explaining its using.
He shook his head.
I think it not a likelihood. A keepsake from a man who was caring for you.
Why are you giving it to me now? Simon asked, feeling a certain sorrowful tightness behind his eyes that he was determined to resist.
Because I must be leaving tomorrow night to go north. If you decide for remaining here, we might not have opportunity to meet again.
Binnebik! The tightening increased. He felt like a small child pushed back and forth between bullying elders.
The truth it is only...
The troll's round face was entirely serious now. He raised his hand to forestall more protests and questions.
Now you must be deciding, my good friend. I go into the snow and ice country on an errand that may be foolishness, and which may claim the lives of the fools who are following it. Those who remain are facing the anger of a king's army. An evil choosing, I fear.
Binnebik nodded his head gravely.
But, Simon, whichever it is for you, going north or staying to fight for Naglimund and Princess, we will be the best of comrades still, yes?
He stood on tiptoe to clap Simon on the upper arm, then turned and walked away across the courtyard toward the archives. Simon found her standing alone, tossing pebbles into the castle well. She wore a heavy traveling cloak and hood against the cold.
Hello, princess, he said.
She looked up and smiled, sadly. For some reason, she seemed much older today, like a grown woman.
Welcome, Simon,
Her breath made a halo of mist about her head. He began to bend his knee in a bow, but she was no longer looking. Another stone rattled down the well. He considered sitting down, which seemed the natural thing to do. But the only place to sit was on the edge of the well, which would either put him uncomfortably close to the princess, or leave him facing in the wrong direction. He decided to remain on his feet. "And how have you been?" he said at last. She sighed. "My uncle treats me as though I am made of eggshells and cobwebs, like I would shatter if I lifted anything, or if anyone bumped into me. I'm sure that he is only worried for your safety, after the dangerous journey you had to get here." "The dangerous journey we had. But nobody's following you around to make sure you don't skin your knee. They're even teaching you how to fight with a sword." "Miri... Princess," Simon was more than a little shocked. "You don't want to fight with swords, do you?" She looked up at him, and their eyes met. For an instant, her stare burned like the noonday sun with some inexplicable longing. A moment later, she wearily dropped her gaze again. "No," she said. "I suppose not. But, oh, I do wish to do something." Surprised, he heard the real pain in her voice, and in that moment remembered her as she had been on the flight up the Stele, uncomplaining and strong, as good a companion as could be wished. "What? What do you want to do?" She looked up again, pleased by the serious tone of his question. "Well," she began, "it's no secret that Josue is having trouble convincing De Vercellis that his master Duke Leobardus should support the prince against my father. Josue could send me to Naban."
"Send you? To Naban?
Of course, you idiot," she frowned. "On my mother's side, I am of the Ingadarain house, the very noble family of Naban. My aunt is married to Leobardus. Who better to go and convince the Duke?" She clapped her gloved hands for emphasis. "Oh," Simon was unsure of what to say. "Perhaps Josue thinks that it would be, I don't know," he considered. "I mean to say, should the High King's daughter be the one to arrange alliances against him? And who knows the High King's ways better?" Now she was angry. "Do you," he hesitated, but his curiosity won out, "how do you feel toward your father?" "Do I hate him?" Her tone was bitter. "I hate what he has become. I hate what the men around him have put him up to. If he would suddenly find goodness in his heart and see the error of his ways, well then, I would love him again." A whole procession of stones went down the well as Simon stood uncomfortably by. "I'm sorry, Simon," she said at last. "I have become very bad at talking with people. My old nurse would be shocked at how much I have forgotten, running around in the forest. How are you, and what have you been doing?"
"Binevik has asked me to go with him, on a mission for Josue," he said, bringing the subject up more abruptly than he had meant to. "To the north," he added significantly. Instead of showing the expressions of worry and fear he had expected, the princess' face seemed to light up from within. Although she smiled at him, she did not truly seem to see him.
"Oh, Simon," she said, "how brave, how fine. Can you... when do you leave?"
"Tomorrow night," he said, dimly aware that somehow, by some mysterious process, asked to go had become going. "But I haven't decided yet," he said feebly. "I thought I might be more needed here at Naglamund, to wield a spear on the walls." He tacked on the last, just in case there was any possibility she thought he might be staying behind to work in the kitchens or something like.
"Oh, but Simon,"
Miriamel said, reaching up suddenly to take his cold hand in her leather-gloved fingers.
"If my uncle needs you to do it, you must. We have so little hope left, from all I have heard."
She reached up to her neck and quickly unfastened the sky-blue scarf she wore, a slender gauzy strip. She handed it to him.
"Take this and bear it for me," she said.
Simon felt the blood come roaring up into his cheeks.
and struggled to keep his lips from stretching into a shocked, mooncalfish grin.
"Thank you, princess," he said at last.
"If you wear it," she said, standing up, "it will be almost as though I were there myself." She did a funny little dance step and laughed.
Simon was trying without success to understand what exactly had happened and how it had happened so fast.
"It will be, princess," he said, "like you were there."
Something in the way he said it tripped up her sudden mood. Her expression turned sober, even sad. She smiled again, a slower, more rueful smile, then quickly stepped forward, startling Simon so that he almost raised a hand to ward her off. She brushed his cheek with her cool lips.
"I know you will be brave, Simon. Come back safely. I shall pray for you."
Immediately she was gone, running across the courtyard like a little girl, her dark cape a smoky swirl as she disappeared into the twilight archway. Simon stood holding her scarf. He thought of it and her smile when she kissed his cheek, and he felt something smolder into flame inside of him. It seemed in some way he did not fully understand that a single torch had been lit against the vast grey chill looming in the north. It was only a single point of brightness in a dreadful storm, but even a lone fire could bring a traveller home safe. He rolled the soft cloth into a ball and slipped it into his shirt.
"I am glad you have come so quickly," Lady Vorsheva said. The brilliance of her yellow dress seemed reflected in her dark eyes.
"My lady honors me," the monk replied, his eyes straying about the room.
Vorsheva laughed harshly.
"You are the only one who thinks it honorable to visit me, but no matter. You understand what it is you must do."
"I am sure that I have it correctly. It is a matter difficult in execution, but easily grasped in concept."
He bowed his head.
"Good. Then wait no longer, for the more wait, the less chance of success. Also more chance for tongues to wag."
She whirled away to the back chamber in a rush of silks.
My lady?"
The man blew on his fingers. The prince's chambers were cold, the fire unlit.
"There is the matter of payment."
"I thought you did this as honor for me, sir,"
Borsheva called from the back room.
"Well, a day, madam, I am but a poor man. What you ask will take resources."
He blew on his fingers again, then thrust his hands deep into his robe. She came back bearing a purse of shiny cloth.
"That I know. Here. It is in gold, as I promised. Half now, half when I receive proof that your task is completed."
She handed him the purse, then drew back.
"You stink of wine. Is that the sort of man you are trusted with this grave task?"
"It is the sacramental wine, my lady. Sometimes on my difficult road it is the only thing to drink. You must understand."
He favored her with a diffident smile, then made the sign of the tree over the gold, before stowing it in the pocket of his robe.
"We do what we must to serve God's will."
Vorsheva nodded slowly.
"That I can understand. Do not fail me, sir. You serve a great purpose, and not just for me."
"I understand, lady."
He bowed, then turned and left. Vorsheva stood and stared at the parchment strewn on the prince's table, and let out a deep breath. The thing was done. Twilight of the day after he spoke to the princess found Simon in the chambers of Prince Joshua, preparing to say farewell. In a sort of daze, as though he had just awakened, he stood listening as the prince had his final words with Pinnabic. The boy and the troll had spent the whole of the dark day preparing their kit, obtaining a new fur-lined cloak and helmet for Simon, along with a light mail shirt to wear beneath his outer clothing. The coat of thin ringlets, Hasten had pointed out, would not save him from a direct sword blow or an arrow to the heart, but would stand him in good stead in the case of some less than deadly assault. Simon found the weight of it reassuring, but Hasten warned him that at the end of a long day's journey, he might not feel so cheerful about it.
Your soldier carries many burdens, boy, the big man told him, and sometimes keeping alive's the hardest one.
Hasten himself had been one of the three Erkinlanders to step forward when the captains had called for men. Like his two companions, Ethelbern, a scarred, bushy-moustached veteran nearly as big as Hasten, and Grimrick, a slender, hawkish man with bad teeth and watchful eyes, he had spent so long preparing for siege that any sort of action was welcome. Even something as dangerous and mysterious as this quest looked to be. When Hasten found out Simon was going too, he was even more adamant in his desire to join them.
To send such a boy's madness, he growled, special when he's not finished learning to swing sword or shoot arrow. I'd best go and keep a-teaching him.
Duke Iskrimnor's man Sluadig was also there, a young Rimmer's man attired like the Erkinlanders in furs and conical helmet. In place of the long sword the others carried, blond-bearded Sluadig had two notch-bladed hand axes thrust in his belt. He grinned cheerfully at Simon, anticipating his question.
Sometimes one gets stuck in a skull or rib cage, the Rimmer's guarder said.
He spoke the Westerling tongue nimbly, with almost as little accent as the Duke.
It is nice to have another to use until you get the first one out.
Nodding, Simon tried to smile back.
Well met again, Simon,
Sluadig extended a calloused hand.
Again?
We met once before at Horiron's Abbey, Sluadig laughed. But you spent the journey us and up across Einskeldi's saddle. I hope that is not the only way you know how to ride.
Simon blushed, clasped the northerner's hand, then turned away.
We have turned up little to help you on your way,
Yarnaga was regretfully telling Binnebik.
The Scandian monks left scant word about Colman's expedition, besides the transactions of its outfitting. They probably thought him a madman.
Most likely they had it correctly, the troll observed.
He was burnishing the bone-handled knife he had carved to replace the missing piece of his staff.
We did find one thing, said Strangyard.
The priest's hair stood up in wild tufts, and his eye patch sat a little off-center as though he had come straight from spending an entire night poring over his books, which he had.
The abbey's bookkeeper wrote, the Baron does not know how long his journeying to the Rhymer's Tree shall last. It is unfamiliar, Yanaga said. In fact, it is probably something the monk misheard or got third hand. But it is a name. Perhaps it will make more sense when you reach the mountain Urmsheim.
Perhaps, said Joshua thoughtfully, it is a town along the way. A village at the mountain's foot.
Perhaps, Binnebik answered doubtfully. But from what I am knowing of those places, there is nothing lying between the ruins of the Skendi monastery and the mountains. Nothing there is but ice, trees, and rocks, of course. Plenty of those things there are.
As final farewells were spoken, Simon heard Sankfugol's voice drift out from the room in back, where he was singing for the Lady Vorsheva. And shall I go a-wandering out in the winter's chill? Or shall I come now home again? Whate'er thou sayest, I will. Simon picked up his quiver and looked for the third or fourth time to make sure the white arrow was still there. Bewildered, as though caught in some slow and clinging dream, he realized that he was setting off on a journey once more, and again he was not quite sure why. His time at Naglamund had been so brief. Now it was over, at least for a long while. As he touched the blue scarf tied loosely at his throat, he realized he might not see any of the others in this room again, anybody at Naglamund, Sankfugol, Holthauser, or Miriam Mell. He thought he felt his heart trip for a moment, the beat stuttering like a drunkard, and was reaching for something to lean on when he felt a strong hand clasp his elbow.
There you be, lad,
it was Hasten.
Bad enough that you've no learning with the sword and bow. Now we're going to put you to horseback.
Horseback? Simon said. I like that.
No, you won't, Hakeston smirked. Not for a month or two.
Joshua said a few words to each one of them. And then there were warm, solemn handclasps all around. A short while later, they were in the dark, cold courtyard, where Kantaka and 7 stamping, steaming horses awaited them, 5 for riding, and a pair for carrying heavy gear. If there was a moon, it was hidden like a sleeping cat in the blanket of clouds.
Good it is that we have this darkness,
Binabik said, swinging up into the new saddle on Kantaka's grey back. The men, seeing the troll steed for the first time, exchanged wondering looks, as Binabik clicked his tongue and the wolf sprang out before them. A group of soldiers quietly raised the oiled portcullis, and they were out under the broad sky, the field of shadowy nails spread around them as they made for the close-looming hills.
Goodbye, everyone, Simon said quietly.
They started up the sloping path. High above on the stela, at the crest of the hill overlooking Naglamund, a black shape was watching. Even with his keen eyes, Ingen Jäger could make out little more in the moonless murk than that someone had left the castle by the eastern gate. That, however, was more than enough to raise his interest. He stood rubbing his hands and considered calling one of his men to go down with him and get a better look. Instead, he lifted his fist to his mouth and hooted like a snow owl. Seconds later, a huge shape appeared from the scrub growth and leaped onto the stela beside him. It was a hound, bigger even than the one killed by the troll's tame wolf, shining white in the moonlight, its eyes twin pearl slots in a long, grinning face. It growled a deep, cavernous rumble and swiveled its head from side to side, nostrils wrinkling.
Yes, Nikoa, yes, Ingen hissed quietly. It is time to hunt once more.
A moment later, the stela was empty. The leaves rattled ever so gently beside the ancient tiles, but no wind was blowing. Chapter 35 The Raven and the Cauldron. Maegwin winced as the clanging began again, the doleful clatter that signified so much, and none of it good. One of the other girls, a small, fair-skinned beauty that Maegwin had assessed at first glance as a quitter, let go of the bar they were all pushing to cover her ears. The heavy piece of fencing meant to hold the gate closed nearly tumbled free, but Maegwin and the 2 other girls clung on grimly.
Bagbas heard Sifkan, she snarled at the one who'd let loose. Are you mad? If this had fallen, someone might have been crushed, or at least broken a foot.
I'm sorry I am, my lady, the girl said, cheeks flushed.
It's just that loud noise. It frightens me.
She stepped back to take her place again, and they all pushed, trying to get the massive oak bar over the top and into the notch that would hold the paddock closed. Inside the restraining fence, a close-packed congregation of red cattle grunted, as unsettled as the young women by the continual din. With a scrape and thump, the log fell down into place, and they all turned, panting, to slump with their backs against the gate.
Merciful are the gods, Maegwin groaned. My spine is breaking. It's not right,
Sifka opined, staring ruefully at the bleeding scratches on her palms.
It's men's work.
The metallic clamor stopped, and for a moment the very silence seemed to sing. Luth's daughter sighed and took in a deep breath of frosty air.
No, little Kefka, she said. What the men are doing now is men's work, and whatever is left to do is women's work, unless you want to carry a sword and spear.
Kefka?
One of the other girls said, laughing.
She won't even kill a spider. I always called Twilith to do it, Kifka said, proud of her fastidiousness, and he always comes to me.
Maegwin made a sour face.
Well, we had better get used to dealing with our own spiders. There will not be many menfolk around in the days to come, and those who remain will have much else to do. It's different for you, princess, Kifka said. You're big and strong.
Maegwin stared hard at her, but did not answer. "You don't think the fighting will go on all summer, do you?" asked another girl, as if speaking of a particularly dreary chore. Maegwin turned to look at them all, at their sweat-dampened faces and their eyes already roaming, looking for something more interesting to talk about. For a moment she wanted to shout, to frighten them into realizing that this was not a tournament, not a game of some sort, but deadly serious. "But why rub their faces in the mud now?" she thought, relenting. "Soon enough, we will all of us get more than we need of it." "I don't know if it will last that long, Gwelyn," she said, and shook her head. "I hope not. I truly hope not." As she made her way down from the paddocks toward the great hall, the two men again started to beat the huge bronze cauldron that hung upside down in its frame of oaken poles before the Taig's front doors. As she trotted past, the noise of the men furiously ringing the cauldron with iron-tipped cudgels was so loud that she had to cover her ears with her hands. She wondered again how her father and his advisers could think, let alone plan, life-and-death strategy, with this awful ruckus just outside the hall. Still, if Rin's cauldron was not rung, it would take days to warn each of the outlying towns one by one, especially those that clung to the slopes of the Greenspog. This way, those villages and manor halls within earshot of the cauldron would send riders to those beyond. The Lord of the Taig had rung the cauldron in times of danger, since long before the days when Herne the Hunter and Oyendath, his mighty spear, had made of their land a great kingdom. Children who had never heard it sounded still recognized it instantly. So many stories of Rin's cauldron were told. The Taig's high windows today were shuttered against the chill wind and mists. Maegwin found her father and his counselors in earnest discussion before the fireplace. "My daughter," Luth said, standing. He expended visible effort to produce a smile for her. "I took some women and got the last of the cattle into the big paddock," Maegwin reported. "I don't think it's right to squeeze them all so tightly. The cows are miserable." Luth waved a dismissive hand.
"Better we lose some few now than have to try and round them up if we must fall back to the hills in a hurry."
At the far end of the hall the door opened, and the sentries banged their swords against their shields once, as though to echo the piercing noise of the summons of the cauldron.
"I do thank you, Maegwin," the king said, turning from her to greet the new arrival. "Eole," he called out as the count strode forward, still dressed in travel-stained clothes. "You are swift in returning from the healers. Good. How are your men?"
The Count of Nad Mullach approached, dropped briefly to one knee, then stood again at Luth's impatient gesture.
"5 are able-bodied. The 2 wounded do not look well. The other 4, I shall call Skali to account for, personally."
He saw Luth's daughter at last and smiled his broad smile, but his brow remained knitted in a weary, troubled study. "My Lady Maegwin," he said, and bowed again, kissing her long-fingered hand, which she was embarrassed to notice was smudged with dirt from the paddock fence.
"I heard you were back, Count," she said. "I only wish it were in happier circumstances." "It's a terrible shame about your brave Molachi, Eole,"
the king said, returning to sit with old Creovan and his other trusted men.
"But thanks be to Brynioch and Morach One-Arm that you stumbled on to that scout party. If not, Skali and his bastard northerners would have been on us unawares. After the skirmish with your men gets back to him, he'll make a much more cautious approach, I'm sure. He may even change his mind altogether."
"I wish that were true, my king," Eole said, shaking his head sadly. Maegwin's heart softened to see how bravely he wore his weariness. She silently cursed her childish emotions. "But," he continued, "I fear it is not for Skali to make such a treacherous attack so far from his home. He must feel sure the odds are leaning his way."
"Why, though? Why?" Luth protested. "We have been at peace with the Rimmer's men for years."
"I think, sire, that has little to do with it," Eole was respectful, but unafraid to correct his king.
If Aldis Grimnor still ruled in Elric's Hala, you would be right to wonder. But Skali is a Elias creature entirely, I think. Rumor in Naban said Elias will go into the field against Joshua any day. He knows we have refused Gothwulf's ultimatum, and he fears to have the Hernistiri unencumbered at his back when he moves against Naglamund.
But Gwethyn is still there, said Maegwin, frightened.
And with half a hundred of our best men, worse luck, old Craven growled from beside the fireplace. Aelle turned to give Maegwin a kind look, the condescending sort, she felt sure. Your brother is doubtless safer behind the thick stone walls of Joshua's castle than he would be here in Hernisadark. Also, if he hears of our plight and can ride out, his 50 men will be at Skali's back to our advantage.
King Luth rubbed his eyes as though to wring out the dismay and worry of the last day.
I do not know, Eole, I do not know. I have a bad feeling about this all. It takes no soothsayer to see an ill-omened year, which this has been from its first instant.
I'm still here, father, Maegwin said,
and went forward to kneel beside him.
I will stay with you.
The king patted her hand. Aelle smiled and nodded at the girl's words to her father, but his mind was obviously on his two dying men, and on the vast force of Rimmer's men moving down the frost march into the Innescrick, a great wave of sharp, sentient iron.
Those who stay will perhaps not thank us, he said beneath his breath.
Outside, the brazen voice of the cauldron sang out across Hernisadark, shouting ceaselessly to the hills beyond.
Beware, beware, beware.
Baron de Vercellis and his small Nabene contingent had somehow contrived to make their row of chambers in Naglamund's drafty east wing into a little bit of their southern home. Although the freakish weather was too cold to allow the wide-open windows and doors, so prevalent in balmy Naban, they had covered the stone walls with bright green and sky-blue tapestries, and filled every available surface with candles and guttering oil lamps, so that the shuttered rooms bloomed with light.
It's brighter in here at noon than it is outside, Iskrimnor decided. But it's like old Jan Auger said. They won't be able to make everything else go away so easy as they have the wintry dark. Not by half.
The Duke's nostrils twitched like those of a frightened horse. The Vercellis had set out pots of scented oils everywhere, some afloat with lighted wicks like white worms, filling the chamber with the thick smells of island spices.
I wonder if it's the smell of everyone's fear he doesn't like, or that of good, honest iron.
Iskrimnor grunted in distaste and slid his chair over by the hallway door. De Vercellis had been surprised to find the Duke and Prince Joshua at his door, unannounced and unexpected, but had quickly invited them in, throwing aside some of the multicolored robes that draped the hard chairs, so his guests could seat themselves. I'm sorry to disturb you, Baron, Joshua said, leaning forward to rest his elbows on his knees. But I wish to speak to you alone before we conclude the raid tonight.
Of course, my prince, of course,
De Vercellis nodded encouragingly, Iskrimnor disdainfully observing the man's shining hair and the glinting baubles he wore at neck and wrist, wondered how he could be the deadly swordsman his reputation declared him.
Looks like he might catch a hilt on his own necklaces and hang himself.
Joshua hurriedly explained the events of the last 2 days, which were the real reason the raid had not continued. De Vercellis, who, like the rest of the assembled lords, had doubted but accepted the prince's claim of illness, raised his eyebrow but said nothing.
I could not talk openly. I still cannot, Joshua amplified. In the mad crush, the muster of local forces, the comings and goings, it would be only too easy for someone of bad faith, or one of Elias' spies, to take the news of our fears and plans to the High King.
But our fears are none to all, De Vercellis said. And we have made no plans, yet.
By the time I am ready to speak of these things to all the lords, I will have made the gates secure. But you see, Baron, you do not yet know all the story. With that, the prince proceeded to tell de Vercellis all the latest discoveries, of the three swords and the prophetic poem in the mad priest's book, and how these things matched with the dreams of many.
But if you will tell all your liegemen this soon enough, why tell me now?
De Vercellis asked. By the doorway, Iskrimnor snorted. He too had wondered this same thing.
Because I need your lord Leobardis, and I need him now, Joshua said. I need Naban.
He stood and began a circuit of the room, facing the walls as though he studied their hangings. But his gaze was focused on a point somewhere leagues beyond the stone and woven cloth.
I have needed your duke's pledge from the beginning, but I need him more now than ever I did.
Elias has given Rimmersgaard for all practical purposes to Skali and his cold Skryker Raven clan. Thus, he has put a knife against King Luth's back. The Hernesteri will be able to send me many fewer men, forced as they will be to keep a quantity back to defend their lands. Already Gwythin, who a week ago was chafing to be at Elias, is anxious to return and help his father defend Hernisadark and its outlands. Joshua whirled to stare de Vercellis in the eyes. The prince's face was a mask of cold pride, but his hand twisted at his shirt front, something neither Iskrimnor or the Baron failed to notice.
If Duke Leobardis ever hopes to be more than a lackey to Elias, he must throw in his lot with me now.
But why do you tell this to me? De Vercellis asked.
He looked honestly puzzled.
I know all of this, last, and the other things, the swords and the book and all, make no difference.
Damn it, man, they do!
Joshua snapped back, his voice rising almost to a shout.
Without Leobardis, and with Hernesteer under the northern threat, my brother will have us as snug as if we were nailed in a barrel. And also, he is dealing with demons. And who can know what dread advantage that means? We have made some small, feeble attempt to counter those forces, but what good will come of it? Even if it succeeds, against all likelihood, if all the freeholds have been already thrown down... Neither your duke nor anyone else will ever answer King Elias with anything but yes, master, from now on.
The Baron shook his head again, and his necklaces clinked gently.
I am confused, my lord. Can it be that you do not know? I sent a message to the Sankelen Mehistrevis in Naban by my fastest rider the night before yesterday, telling Leobardis I believed you would fight and that he should move to put his men into the field in your support.
What? Iskrimnor leaped up, his astonishment echoing the prince's. They both stood swaying over de Vercellis, their expressions those of men ambushed by night.
Why have you not told me? Joshua demanded.
But my prince, I did tell you, de Vercellis sputtered. Or, at least, since I was advised you might not be disturbed, I sent the message to your chambers with my seal on it. Surely you read it?
Blessed Osiris and his mother!
Joshua smacked his open left hand against his thigh.
I have only myself to blame, for it sits even now on my bedside table. Deolnoth brought it to me, but I was waiting for a quieter moment. I suppose I forgot. Still, it is no harm done, and your news is excellent.
You say Leobardis will ride? Iskrimnor asked suspiciously. How are you so sure? You seem to have more than a few doubts yourself. Duke Iskrimnor,
de Vercellis' tone was frosty.
Surely you realize I was only fulfilling my duty. In truth, Duke Leobardis has long been in sympathy with Prince Joshua. Likewise, he has feared Elias is becoming overbold. The troops have been on alert for weeks.
Then why send you? Joshua asked. What did he think to discover that he did not have already from me through my messengers?
He sought nothing new, de Vercellis said, although there has been far more learned here than I think any of us bargained for. No, he sent my embassy more to make a show for certain others in Naban.
There is resistance among his liegemen? Joshua asked, eyes bright.
Of course, but that is not unusual. Nor is it the source of my mission. It was to undermine resistance from a closer source. Here, although the smallish chamber was obviously empty but for the three of them, De Vasselis darted a look on all sides. It is his wife and son who resist most strongly his making common cause with you, De Vasselis said at last. You mean the eldest? Benigaris? Yes, else he or one of Leobardi's younger sons should have been here in my stead. The Baron shrugged. Benigaris sees much he likes in Elias' rule, and the Duchess Nesalante. The Nabene emissary shrugged again. She too favors the High King's chances? Joshua smiled bitterly. Nesalante is a clever woman. Too bad that now she will be forced, willy-nilly, to support her husband's choice of allies. She might well be correct in her misgivings. Joshua, his Grimnor was shocked. I only jest, old friend, the prince said, but his expression belied him. So the Duke will go into the field, then, good De Vasselis. As soon as possible, Prince Joshua, with the cream of Naban's knights in his train. And a strong dollop of pikemen and archers as well, I hope. Well, Aedon's grace on us all, Baron. He and his Grimnor said their farewells and went out into the dark corridor. The bright colors of the Baron's chamber left behind them like a dream abandoned at the lip of awakening. One person I know will be very glad of this news, Iskrimnor. The Duke raised a questioning eyebrow. My niece? Miriam El was very upset when she thought Leobardis might not come over. Nesalanta is her aunt, after all. She'll be glad of this news indeed. Let us go tell her, Iskrimnor proposed, taking Joshua's elbow and guiding him out toward the courtyard. She may be with the other court ladies. I'm tired of looking at whiskery soldiers. I may be an old man, but I still like to look on a lady or two from time to time. So be it, Joshua smiled, the first unforced example Iskrimnor had seen in several days. Then we'll go by and visit your wife. And you may tell her about your undiminished love of the ladies. Prince Joshua, the old Duke said carefully, you'll never be too damn old or exalted that I can't knuckle your ears, just you see if I can't. Not today, Uncle, Joshua smirked. I'll need him to appreciate just what Guthrum has to say to you. The wind soughing in off the water carried the smell of cypress. Tiamak, wiping beads of sweat from his brow, gave silent thanks to he who always steps on sand for the unexpected breeze. Coming back from checking his trapline, he had felt the storm-charged air descend on the Ran. Hot, angry air that came and would not go away, like a March crocodile circling a leaking skiff. Again Tiamak wiped his forehead dry, and reached for the bowl of yellow root tea steeping on the firestone. As he sipped, not without some pain to his cracked lips, he worried over what he should do. It was Morgaini's strange message that disturbed him. For days its ominous words had rattled in his head like pebbles in a dry gourd, as he poled his boat through the byways of the Ran, or made his way to market in Kwanetupur, the trading village that crouched along the outlet stream from Lake Eadna. He made the three-day flatboat trip to Kwanetupul once every new moon, putting his unusual schooling to good advantage at the marketing stalls, helping the smaller Ranaman merchants to bargain with the Nabene and Perdruanese traders who worked the Ran's coastal villages. The taxing journey to Kwanetupul was a necessity, if only to earn a few coins and perhaps a bag of rice. The rice he used to supplement that occasional crab, too stupid or too cocksure to avoid his traps. There were not many crabs so obliging, however, which was the reason Tiamak's usual table fare was fish and roots. As he crouched in his tiny banyan-perched cabin, anxiously turning over Morgaini's message for the 100th time, he thought back to the bustling hilly streets of Ancis Pelipe, Perdruin's capital,
where he and the old doctor had first met. As much as the clamour and spectacle of the vast trading port, 100, no, many hundreds of times the size of Quanitupol. A fact that his fellow Rannaman would never believe, provincial sand-scuffing louts that they were. It was the smells Tiamak remembered most strongly, the million shifting scents. The dank salt smell of the wharves, spiced with the tang of the fishing boats. The cook fires in the streets where bearded island men offered skewers of bubbling charred mutton. The musk of sweating, champing horses, whose proud riders, merchants, and soldiers cantered boldly down the middle of the cobbled streets, letting the pedestrians scatter where they might. And of course, the swirling odors of saffron and quickweed, of cinnamon and mantinges, that eddied through the spice district like fleeting, exotic solicitations. Just the memories made him so hungry he almost wanted to weep, but Tiamak steeled himself. There was work to be done, and he could not be distracted by such fleshly obsessions. Morghenis needed him, somehow, and Tiamak had to be ready. In fact, it had been food that had brought him to Morghenis' attention all those years ago in Perdruin. The doctor, on some kind of apothecarical search through the trading districts of Ancis Pelipe, had bumped into and almost knocked over the Rannaman youth. So intently was young Tiamak eyeing an array of marchpane on a baker's table. The doctor was amused and intrigued by the marsh lad so far from home, whose apologies to the older man were so full of carefully learned Nabene idiom. When Morghenis learned that the boy was in Perdruin's capital to study with the Osirian brothers, and was the first of his village to leave the swamp he ran, he bought him a large square of marchpane and a cup of milk. From that moment on, Morghenis was as a god to the astounded Tiamak. The smudged sheet of parchment before him, even though itself a copy of the original message that had fallen to pieces from handling, was nevertheless becoming hard to read. He had stared at it so many times, however, that it no longer mattered. He had even placed it back into its original ciphers and retranslated it, just to make sure he had not missed some subtle but important detail.
"The time of the Conqueror Star is surely upon us," the doctor had written,
in the course of warning Tiamak this would likely be his last letter for a long while. Tiamak's help would be needed, Morghenis assured him.
"If certain dreadful things which it is said are hinted at in the infamous lost book of the priest Nisse's,
were to be avoided." The first time he had gone to Quenitupol, after receiving Morghenis' sparrow-borne message, Tiamak asked Midastri, a Perdruinese merchant with whom he sometimes drank a bowl of beer, what dreadful things were happening in Urchester, the city where Morghenis lived in Erkinland. Midastri said he had heard of strife between the High King Elias and Luth of Hernesteer, and of course everyone had been talking about the falling out between Elias and his brother Prince Joshua for months. But beyond that, the merchant could think of nothing special. Tiamak, who from Morghenis' message had feared danger of a vaster and more immediate sort, had felt a little better. Still, the import of the doctor's message tugged at him.
The infamous lost book.
How had Morghenis known the secret? Tiamak had not told anyone. He had wanted to surprise the doctor with it on a visit he had planned to make next spring, his first time ever north of Perdruin. Now it appeared Morghenis already knew something of his prize, but why didn't he say so? Why should he instead hint and riddle and suggest, like a crab carefully poking the fish head out of one of Tiamak's traps? The Rannaman set down his bowl of tea and moved across the low-ceilinged room, hardly rising from his bent-kneed crouch. The hot sour wind began to blow a little more strongly, rocking the house on its tall stilts, lifting the thatch with a serpentine hiss. He searched in his wooden chest for the leaf-wrapped thing, carefully hidden below the sack of parchment that was his own rewriting of Sovereign Remedies of the Ranna Healers, what Tiamak secretly liked to think of as his great work. Finding it at last, he brought it out and unwrapped it, not for the first time in the last fortnight. As it lay beside his transcription of Morghenis' message, he was taken by the contrast. Morgaini's words were painstakingly copied in black root ink on cheap parchment, beaten so thin, a candle flame held a hand's breadth away might puff it into flame. The other, the prize, was scribed on a sheet of tight-stretched skin or hide. The reddish-brown words trailed crazily across the page, as though the writer had been a horseback, or sitting at a table during an earth tremor. This last was the jewel of Tiamak's collection. Indeed, if he was right about what it was, would be the crowning gem of anyone's collection. He had found it in a great pile of other used parchments. A trader in Quenitupol was selling for scribing practice. The trader had not known who the chest of papers had belonged to, only that he had gotten it as part of a blind lot of household goods in Naban. Fearing that his good fortune might evaporate, Tiamak had stifled the urge to question further, and bought it on the spot, along with a sheaf of other parchments, for one shiny Nabine Kinis piece. He stared at it again, although he had read this more times even than Morgaini's message, if such was possible. And especially at the top of the parchment, not so much torn as gnawed, whose disfigurement ended with the letters Ardenweird. Was not Nisse's famous vanished volume, some even called it imaginary, named Dusfardenweird? How had Morgaini's known? Tiamak had not yet told anyone of his lucky find. Beneath the title, the northern runes smeared in some places, flaking away into rust-colored powder in others, were nevertheless quite readable, written in the archaic Nabine of 5 centuries gone. Bring from Nuan his rock garden, the man who, though blinded, can see, discover the blade that delivers the rose at the foot of the Rimmer's great tree. Find the call whose loud acclaim, speak as the call bearer's name, in a ship on the shallowest sea, when blader, call, and man come to prince's right hand, then the prison shall once more go free. Below the strange poem, a single name was printed in large, awkward runes, Nisse's. Although Tiamak stared and stared, inspiration still remained anguishingly distant. At last, sighing, he rolled the ancient scroll back in its pocket of preservative leaves and tucked it into his burwood chest. What then did Morgaini's want him to do? Bring this thing to the doctor himself at the Hayholt? Or should he instead send it to another wise one, like the witch-woman Jaloi, Fat Ukekuk up in Yikanuk, or the fellow in Naban? Perhaps the wisest plan was merely to wait for Dr. Morgaini's further word, instead of hurrying off foolishly without full understanding. After all, from what Medastri had told him, whatever Morgaini's feared must still be a long way off. There was certainly time to wait until he knew what it was that the doctor wanted. Time and patience, he counseled himself. Time and patience. Outside his window the cypress branches groaned, suffering beneath the wind's rough handling. The chamber door flew open. Sangfugel and the Lady Vorsheva leaped up guiltily, as if they had been caught in some impropriety, although the length of the chamber separated them. As they looked up, wide-eyed, the minstrel's lute, which had been propped against his chair, tilted and fell over at his feet. He hurriedly caught it up and held it against his breast, as though it were an injured child. "Damn you, Vorsheva, what have you done?" Joshua demanded. Duke Iskrimnor stood behind him in the doorway, wearing a worried look. "Be calm, Joshua," he urged, tugging at the prince's grey jerkin. "When I have the truth from this woman," Joshua spat. "Until then, stay out of this, old friend." Color was returning fast to Vorsheva's cheeks.
"What is your meaning?" she said. "You knock indoors like a bull and shut questions. What is your meaning?"
"Do not seek to gull me. I have just come from speaking to the gate captain. I am sure he wishes I had never found him, so angry I was. He told me that Miriam Mell went out yesterday forenoon with my permission, which was no permission, but instead my seal attached to a false document."
"And why do you shout at me?"
the lady asked haughtily. Sangfugel began to sidle toward the chamber door, still clutching his wounded instrument.
That you know full well,
Joshua growled, the flush finally beginning to fade from his pale features.
And stay where you are, Harper, for I'm not done with you. You have been much in my lady's confidence of late.
At your command, Prince Joshua, Sangfugel said haltingly, to ease her loneliness. But of the Princess Miriamel, I swear, I know nothing. Joshua moved forward into the chamber, swinging the heavy door shut behind him without a look back. Isgrimnor, nimble despite his years and girth, skipped out of its way.
Good Vosheva, do not treat me as though I were one of the wagon boys you grew up with. All I have heard from you is how the poor princess is sad. The poor princess is missing her family. Now Miriamel is gone out the gate with some villain and some other confederate has used my seal ring to give her safe passage. I am no fool!
The dark-haired woman returned his stare for a moment. Then her lip began to tremble. Angry tears started in her eyes as she sat back down, long skirts rustling.
Very well, Prince Joshua, she said. Cut my head off if you like. I have helped the poor girl to go away to her family in Naben. If you were not so heartless, you would have sent her yourself with armed men to escort. Instead, all she has for company is a kind monk.
She pulled a kerchief from the bosom of her dress and dabbed her eyes.
Still, she is happier that way than to be cooped up here like a bird in a cage.
Tears of Elysia,
Joshua swore, throwing his hand in the air.
You foolish woman!
Miriamel wanted only to play at being an emissary. She thought to find glory by bringing her Nabene relatives into this struggle on my side.
Perhaps it is not fair to say glory, Joshua, Isgrimnor cautioned. I think the princess honestly means to help.
And what is wrong with that?
Asked Vosheva defiantly.
You need the help of Naben, do you know?